I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, we'll be examining the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks in the United States, 17 years on, with the help of Brian McGlinchey, founder of 28pages.org. Founded in July 2014, 28pages.org has sought to answer some of the more unsettling questions arising from that fateful September day. And I'm not talking about wacky notions that no planes hit the World Trade Center, or even missiles being driven into the Pentagon and other conspiracy theories of that nature. No, 28pages.org was founded as an information and activism hub to shed a much-needed light on the formerly classified 28 pages of the 9/11 Joint Inquiry Report, detailing the links that tie Saudi Arabia, our supposed ally, to those horrendous attacks. Without further ado, I present my conversation with Brian McGlinchey, founder of 28pages.org, 17 years after the moment in history that shook the United States to its core and haunts the American psyche to this very day. Welcome to Parallax Views, Brian McGlinchey.
Great to be with you.
So I wanted to have you on because we're coming up on the 17th anniversary of September 11th. And you help run a website called 28pages.org. And, you know, a lot of people will take two views on 9/11. You have the people that say, well, everything's been answered already. We have the 9/11 Commission. And then you have, you know, online you have like the weird conspiracy sort of like people that are into Alex Jones and stuff. Mm-hmm. But 28 pages, it doesn't really take either of those approaches. What is 28 pages about?
28pages.org is a website that I launched in 2014. And the original purpose of the website was to help the cause, help to bring about the declassification of 28 pages on Saudi government links to 9/11 that had been kept under wraps for many a year. These pages are from a joint congressional inquiry into 9/11 that came before the 9/11 Commission. We'll probably talk, you know, more about both of those things later. But I had seen a press conference about this topic from Thomas Massie, Walter Jones, Stephen Lynch, three congressmen who were leading the charge on Capitol Hill to get these 28 pages declassified. I was intrigued about it by it just because I take an intense interest in foreign policy, and Congressman Thomas Massie, somebody who already had my respect, so when he said he wanted to get these pages out and that the American public should see it, I kind of felt a call to action. And since writing was a talent of mine, I just decided to create the website 28pages.org to serve as an information hub, an activism hub, so that you had this channel being worked of the members of Congress pushing, but I wanted to help facilitate citizen involvement. People calling Congress, writing letters, getting involved, bringing about the pressure on the White House to declassify those pages. They were declassified in 2016. And then after that, I've continued to write about Saudi links to 9/11 and also some other long-term. I want to increasingly broaden the scope to study many aspects of the Saudi war on terror, but kind of like the line from The Godfather 3, every time I think I'm out of examining Saudi Arabia and the 9/11 things, I get pulled back in by a new story that comes to me or new developments or following the civil suit that's going on. We'll talk some more about that too, no doubt, which is the 9/11 families, survivors, and insurers who have been engaged in a civil suit seeking to pin liability for the attacks on the Saudi government.
And that's actually one of the first things I wanted to get into. Something that a lot of people I don't think realize about 9/11 and its aftermath is that there were a number of families who were affected by the attacks. Most notably, this group of widows who have famously become known as the Jersey Girls, and they've been fighting to get justice on the 9/11 case almost since the beginning, I believe. Do you know anything about their story, or could you relay that to my listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very much a newcomer to this, relatively speaking. Yeah, only creating this website in 2014. Yeah, long before that, you had these Jersey Girls and many other family members who've been pursuing transparency about 9/11 and accountability for 9/11. The Jersey Girls are four widows whose husbands worked in, I think all four worked in the World Trade Center. Kristen Breitweiser, Patty Casaza, Laurie Van Alken, and Mindy Kleinberg are the four who are called the Jersey Girls. And these were, I think all of them were New Jersey housewives who, obviously suffered an unimaginable horror on September 11th and soon after became involved very much politically. And these were not political people. These were wives and mothers who felt that their government had let them down, obviously in protecting the country, but also after the fact in terms of offering due transparency, not only to them, but to all the citizens of this country, because we were all affected on that day. So we can really credit the 9/11 Commission to the Jersey Girls and those who they had working with them too. It was their relentless pressure on Capitol Hill, making TV appearances and all this type of thing from a very, very much grassroots and off the kitchen counter type of a campaign to bring about that pressure that ultimately made President Bush, against his initial plans and against his instincts to support the launching of the 9/11 Commission. Their influence extended beyond that. Once the 9/11 Commission started rolling, they were continued to be involved in it, and in fact played a very pivotal role right out of the gate in that the original vision was for the 9/11 Commission to be chaired by Henry Kissinger, and the Jersey Girls and others were a little bit alarmed by that. They thought he would not be a very good choice for this, given his international connections and dealings and so forth. And he hosted them soon after he'd been named or nominated for this role. And they started asking some very pointed questions. One of them finally said, "Look, are some of your clients?" Because he has a consulting business for foreign governments. "Are any of your clients Saudi citizens? Are any of them named bin Laden?" And the account is that he was pouring coffee at the moment he asked that, and literally spilled it and fell out of his chair at the moment of that. And the next day he called President Bush to withdraw his name from consideration. So, but just one anecdote of their kind of diligence being a watchdog over the 9/11 commission as it proceeded, and it didn't stop with that.
Right. And I think they were spurred on. I always like to make this clear because I've talked about this with a few people. And like I said, you have a lot of misinformation online that, like I said, there's a sort of tinfoil hat contingent that wants to bring up the 9/11 conspiracy theories. The Jersey mm-hmm. Girls and what you're doing, I don't think anyone should associate it with that. It's dealing with these Saudi links, which I think to most people are an open secret in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah. The Jersey Girls, the work I do, and most of the 9/11 family members that I'm in contact with and familiar with. They're all focused on facts, and they're all focused on hard evidence and facts, not wild speculation and the tendency of many to kind of have a pet fringe theory, and then nothing will come between them and that theory, and contrary evidence. If you offer it, people will say, "Oh, well, that was planted," that type of thing. You can't. Once they're in love with that theory, it's off and running. There's no pulling them back. So exactly, this is the kind of avenues we're on is very factual. And it's also important to point out that the Jersey Girls are kind of the stars, but the among the most prominent, most well known of the people. But really, there's many 9/11 family members who've been involved in pressuring the government up until this very day. And not just widows. You've got a son like Brett Eagleson is a 9/11 son up in Connecticut who was at a press conference last week with Connecticut Senator Blumenthal on the push to declassify 9/11 documents. And also, we think about a lot about family members, but then too there are survivors who suffered extreme trauma and people who have been many survivors who are also wanting to get to the bottom of Saudi links and other acts of negligence by the government and that type of thing.
Right. And I'm just curious. So, what led these not just the Jersey Girls, but these other people associated with the September 11th advocates? What led them down this rabbit hole of exploring the Saudi links and pushing our government to investigate it?
Well, it's, for those of us who weren't directly affected by 9/11, we think of 9/11 as a spectacular historical event, or broadly as a enormous terrorist attack. But ultimately, for these people who were directly affected, it was a mass murder. So these are family members of murder victims, or people who suffered trauma in an attempted murder, who were fortunately able to get out of the tower that day. Not to mention all the people who have been, from breathing the dust. We continue to see headlines of first responders and other people, dying to this very day of symptoms. It's kind of a ticking time bomb for a lot of people who were up there wondering if they'll be next, just from breathing it. They got out.
I think it was asbestos poisoning, right?
Yeah, well, if you can imagine all the material that was in those buildings, it being pulverized, all the stuff that's in computers. I mean, you just had a real toxic brew of things there. So, for somebody who's, take the number down from 3,000 to 1, if it's your loved one and they were murdered and you feel that people who aided and abetted the attacks haven't been held accountable, you're going to want to get to the bottom of it. You want that sense of justice and accountability for anybody who was involved in your loved one's murder.
Right. And I think what I was getting at is we always hear, right after 9/11, it was, we have to go into Afghanistan. We have to mm-hmm. go into Afghanistan. And sort of this Saudi link wasn't really explored a lot, early on. So my question to you is, like, how did people like yourself and the Jersey Girls and these other activists and families start looking at that angle?
That's a good question. You know, early on, you could say, well, the Saudi links weren't explored a lot. Really, what we could say is that the Saudi links were actively concealed and actively hidden by our government. I'm not exactly sure when it would have first crossed the radar of the Jersey Girls and others. And it's important to note that, you know, as the Jersey Girls were getting started, it wasn't Saudi focused necessarily at the beginning. It was this sense of accountability. Hey, we need to study this entire thing. You know, how did our defense fail us? You know, what warnings did we have?
It was a matter of the looking at the intelligence failures that led to this and holding people accountable for that. Yeah.
Right. So they had a broad kind of view and broad objectives that weren't necessarily just specifically Saudi focused. But I think, you know, pretty early on, you started to have whispers and things coming out of investigations about the Saudi links. You know, before the 9/11 commission, we had the joint congressional inquiry into intelligence failures, you know, before and after the 9/11 attacks. And the this was a unprecedented joint undertaking of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. One of the key figures in that was then Senate Intelligence Chair Bob Graham, the Florida senator. And he, from the very, you know, from way back when, has been urging more transparency about Saudi government links to the 9/11 attacks. So very early on, he was being vocal about that. When the joint inquiry concluded, it produced a report of many hundred pages. And throughout that report, there were many redactions, you know, names and places, that type of thing, you know, here and there peppered throughout. But then the entire final chapter was completely redacted, completely sealed. You know, this was a tug of war between the House committees and the White House on this final public report and how much of it would be visible to the public. And the White House would not yield. They insisted this entire final chapter, 28 pages long, and thus the name of my website, and the name of, you know, the effort to get them released, this entire 28 pages was completely blanked out, not just names, but everything. And these detailed Saudi kind of summarized leads that pointed towards Saudi Arabia. And these were, again, these were blanked out, withheld at the insistence of the George Bush administration. And this gets to really a central motivation for me to launch 28pages.org when I did, which is that it really illustrates a fundamental hypocrisy in the U.S. response to war on terror, the U.S. execution of the war on terror, the U.S. statements about the nature of terrorism, and specifically that at the very same time the government was classifying 28 pages of bona fide links associating the attacks with the Saudi government, hiding those from view. At the very same time they're doing that, you had the government constructing false links between the 9/11 attacks and the Iraqi government, because that was the agenda, was to invade Iraq. And so the more the U.S. citizens associated Iraq with 9/11, the more palatable that war was going to be. And so that kind of gets to that fundamental hypocrisy.
And I want to make sure my listeners understand this too, because I feel like a lot of people may be unfamiliar with the joint inquiry, because most people know about the 9/11 commission. So these are two different investigations.
Yes, and you'll see even in major media outlets to this day, they'll say 28 pages from the 9/11 commission report, but a lot of people get that wrong. And I confess, when I first started taking interest in the issue, that's what the impression I had. But yeah, before the 9/11 commission, which was a, you know, sort of an independent blue ribbon panel put together, you know, with its own budget and everything to investigate 9/11 in all facets of it. Before that happened, you had the House and Senate Intelligence Committees create a joint inquiry, which I guess lasted probably a year, you know, over a year of looking at of that. And they were focused on the intelligence community's activities before and after 9/11, and digging into that aspect of it. So not as quite as broad. You know, the 9/11 Commission would have also looked at, you know, what did the FAA do? What was the defense response? That type of thing. So this is really focused on intelligence community activities. And so that report came out in 2003 with that last page, that last 28-page chapter on Saudi links to 9/11 blanked out completely. And straight out of the gate, you had Senator Bob Graham, the Intelligence Committee chair, urging publicly, you know, campaigning for those, and condemning the Bush administration for classifying them and, you know, pushing for them to be released, organizing a, letter from 46, I believe, members of the Senate, you know, urging that they be released. And so that was way back in 2003. And it wasn't until 2016 that those 28 pages were declassified in the last year of the Obama administration.
Yeah, and I think Senator Bob Graham, who was a senator in Florida, he became very well known for making statements about other countries being involved in the attacks. I don't know which year he did that in, but I think it was shortly after the joint inquiry was done.
Yeah, and as time went on, he became more and more pointed and vivid. You know, he may have started with other countries, but by the time, 2014 rolls around and I jump in with 28pages.org, he's being very pointed and naming Saudi Arabia and talking about the various indicators that he can talk about of connections there.
Well, he's very much one of the people leading the push to get this information out there to the public.
Yeah, absolutely. So he was sort of an alumni leader because he was no longer in the Senate. So he was out speaking on television, working with media and so forth on that. And then you had active members of Congress, and the most prominent of those leading that charge to get the 20 pages released and now to, you know, push for even more material to be released is Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina. And he's been through an interesting journey philosophically. Listeners might remember the term freedom fries, right? You had when the French did not want to cooperate and facilitate the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, U.S. led. You might remember a congressman said, "Oh, well, in the House dining room, we're not going to call them French fries anymore. We're going to call them freedom fries." That was Walter Jones. He now absolutely emphatically regrets having voted for the war in Iraq. He feels like he, like the rest of us, were absolutely deceived as the Bush administration was creating the pretense by which we would justify invading that country. When you see interviews with him, he's really plagued with guilt, and you see it's tangible. And he has made it a personal campaign to send a letter to every lost service member since then, a personal letter expressing his regret. And on the other side, he's been working very hard for 9/11 families and for everybody else who wants to get to the bottom of this to get more of this information released. So he was really the key person leading the charge on Capitol Hill with a House resolution to help push for those 28 pages to be released.
When we look at these 28 pages, another thing that I think listeners should understand is, you know, I think a lot of people know that I forget how many of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, but it,
yeah,
it 15. Goes much 13?
15.
15, okay. 15 of them came from Saudi Arabia, but the ties go much deeper than that. Could you just give a sort of overview of that?
Sure, yeah. Yeah, JG, I've probably written about 150 articles on this. I've never once mentioned that 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, because it's the very least of anything. You know, they could have been, the Saudi government could have been facilitating people from another country doing it, and you know, you'd still have these links. So it's like the least compelling thing. It's the easiest thing for the media to mention. Unfortunately, sometimes it's all they mention, and you're left with the thought that, oh, that's the whole case rests on that. Well, that's not it. Really, what you've got is Well, I guess I'd kind of talk through some of the things that we do know about the Saudi links to 9/11. Is that one of the key storylines you look at is in San Diego, where two future 9/11 hijackers, Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar, arrived in Los Angeles, and immediately we see that their stay in the country and getting oriented to the country is being facilitated by people who appear to be associated with the Saudi government. And specifically, these two future hijackers, they arrive in Los Angeles, okay? And around the same time, you've got a man in Southern California, a Saudi citizen named Omar Bayoumi, who lived in San Diego. He has a no-show job at a Saudi aviation company. You know, you hear about no-show jobs on mafia shows and that type of thing, but you literally had a job at an aviation company where they said, "Oh, well, he never showed up." So he's getting money, you know, for this job not showing up. He lives in San Diego. He one day is summoned and drives up to the Saudi consulate in Los Angeles, where a consular official named Thumari hosts him. And they have a meeting, and after that meeting, Bayoumi immediately goes to a Mediterranean restaurant. Then he realizes he's not at the right one. He goes to another Mediterranean restaurant. Okay, there, when he gets there, are Nawaf al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midar, these two future 9/11 hijackers. He told investigators, "Oh, just a coincidence that I happened to run into these two." He proceeds to then facilitate them moving from, you know, Los Angeles, where they'd probably be staying in a hotel, I believe, to San Diego. He pays their initial rent, sets them up an apartment, introduces them to people, gets them situated. And he, you know, he says, "Well, it's just a coincidence and I was being gracious." He receives money then. His income dramatically increases during the time that he's in San Diego and the hijackers are in San Diego. This money that's being funneled from the Saudi government into the Saudi aviation company for this no-show job. Then the income falls when those two move on to another part of the country many, many months later. And then he leaves the country a few weeks before 9/11. Another connection in this San Diego story that we have is a man named Osama Basnan, another Saudi, living in that area. Now, from the 28 pages and another reporting we have, we know that Basnan was considered to be an absolute extremist who viewed Osama bin Laden, quote, as a god, end quote, said one of the reports, and who had helped host a reception for the blind sheikh who was involved in the initial World Trade Center bombing. It was bombed before it was brought down. And from the 20 pages and others, we know that he and his wife received money from the Saudi ambassador to the United States and his wife. We're talking about Prince Bandar. And Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador, very, very close friends with the Bush family. You've got direct cash payments going from this extremist to this extremist who, according to one source that's cited in the 28 pages, had bragged that he had given more assistance to these two 9/11 hijackers than did Bayoumi. So that kind of gives you a feeling for, you know, one of the key storylines that we have linking Saudi officials to the 9/11 attacks.
Right, right. And this is another thread I want to get on, because the objection I always see brought up is that the 9/11 Commission is always referenced by U.S. and Saudi government officials as saying that these Saudi links are fictitious, and that renders the joint inquiry, those 28 pages don't matter. How would you respond to that?
Yeah, at the time the 28 pages were coming out, you saw a big PR push, not just by the Saudi government, but by its fellow travelers in the U.S. Intelligence Committee and the U.S. government and the Obama administration, to discredit them, you know, to say, never mind, you should disregard these. And, you know, what you're saying is, you know, pretty much what was being said, that, these were just hasty preliminary leads, and, you know, you don't have to worry about those. People said, you know, they're hidden because it was so tentative, and Senator Graham made the point that that last chapter is part of a multi-hundred page report, and nobody said that about the rest of the report. So it's not like you suddenly come to the last chapter and the wheels fall off and it's just this sloppy throw it against the wall thing. You know, these were, you know, very thoughtfully investigated things. The other point people will make is that these were preliminary. What the real final authority is the 9/11 Commission report, which came after that.
Can I comment real quick? From what I understand, even members of the 9/11 Commission say that they feel the investigation was botched in a lot of ways, their own investigation.
Oh yeah, you've got members of the 9/11 Commission who've said that the leads pointing to 9/11 were never thoroughly investigated. And I'm not talking about just anyone. I'm talking about actual members of the commission, like the former Secretary of the Navy John Lehman and others who said, look, the 9/11 Commission did not thoroughly investigate these. And if you look at and study the 9/11 Commission, and I would really recommend, you know, for your audience members that are interested in this topic, a book called The Commission by Philip Sheehan. Really interesting and thorough study of how the commission proceeded. You get firsthand accounts from, again, Secretary of the Navy Lehman saying that, look, every time we wanted to get information about Saudi Arabia, as we were investigating this, you know, you'd run into a brick wall, that there was this compulsion to, here's the quote, they were refusing to declassify anything having to do with Saudi Arabia. Anything having to do with the Saudis, for some reason, it had this very special sensitivity. You know, he was going to the White House himself saying, look, what is the deal, you know, why we can't get more information out of Saudi Arabia? The commission did not use its subpoena power. You know, the whole question, should we subpoena people and really compel them, full cooperation by the government? But they didn't, you know, they didn't forcefully do that. Bob Kerry, a former senator who was on the commission, he said, quote, evidence relating to the plausible involvement of possible Saudi government agents in the September 11th attacks has never been fully pursued. So it kind of goes on and on in terms of this. And then you've got conflicts of interest on this commission, where, you know, it's, keep in mind, the Bush administration hid those 28 pages. The Bush administration and the Bush family has a very close relationship with the Saudi royal family. Less than 2 days after the attacks, you have Prince Bandar smoking cigars on the Truman balcony of the White House with Bush and Cheney and Condoleezza Rice. You know, very close relationship. And the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, or Zelikow, he, you know, this is somebody who co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice, who was very close in that way. And, you know, whenever the government does an after action type study of anything, you know, we would love to think as American citizens that the aim is getting to the truth and wrapping it all up for us and presenting us the facts. But, you know, for pretty much any government entity, the overarching goal is to avoid embarrassment and to protect reputations and budgets and that type of thing. And the 9/11 Commission was not thorough, it was deeply flawed many ways. I'll give you one more anecdote about Zelikow. One of the investigators who was studying the Saudi leads was Dana Lieseman. She had served on that joint inquiry as investigator, okay, which came before that. Now the 9/11 Commission is ramping up. And they're basically picking up then with where they left off. Some of these same investigators are now working on the 9/11 Commission. She helped write the 28 pages for that joint inquiry. Now, in her work for the commission, she wanted to access those 28 pages again so she could pick up and move forward. Well, Zelikow kept blocking her from reading these 28 pages. I mean, from accessing what she had already produced herself. And she finally got fed up, went around him, you know, used a back channel to get the copy of the 28 pages so she could work on it. And he fired her for doing so. So that's just one more anecdote that shows you this. And I'll throw in one more. A couple of years ago, a 9/11 commission document was quietly declassified. Document 17, first reported at 28pages.org. There's an article there your readers can check out. I'm sorry, your listeners can check out. And this showed this document was basically a plan. It was a document from the beginning of the 9/11 commission where they were laying out their plan of attack, if you will, for how we're going to move forward with our investigation. And this document specifically deals with the Saudi issue. And one of the they're outlining a whole bunch of different avenues of questions that they want to pursue as they move forward with that investigation. And one of them was they wanted to study the extent to which political factors had influenced the investigation of Saudi links to 9/11. That's pretty intriguing that, okay, they're laying out the important questions they want to study in the 9/11 commission. And obviously a lot of them were relating to, like I was talking about, the San Diego and other facts that they knew. But here you've got them laying out as one of the most important questions is the extent to which political considerations were affecting the investigation of Saudi links to 9/11. Now, interestingly, we never hear about that again. There's nothing in the 9/11 commission about that. So, I mean, these investigators outlined that and nominated that as one of the important critical questions. But then somebody decided, well, we're not going to study that, or we're not going to include that in our report.
Wow. And I want to get into some of your current reporting on the lawsuits happening now, and also your interview with Kenneth Williams. But I do want to ask one question real quick, because I know some laymen have always asked me this when I bring up the Saudi links question. They say to me, well, JG, Saudi Arabia is an ally of the U.S. Why would they have funded these terrorist attacks on us?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I'm glad you brought that into the discussion, because, yeah, it's people think, well, look, we're an ally. We've got arms deals and oil deals. Why would they want to attack the United States? Really, to understand 9/11, you need to go back and understand 1979. What happened in 1979 in Saudi Arabia was extremists who took over the holy mosque at Mecca, you know, the most holy revered site in Islam. And these were people, extremists, who were saying, look, the Saudi royal family needs to go. They are not true adherents to the Wahhabi thread of Islam, the Wahhabi.
Which is the extremist, the extremist form of Islam engaged in the type of terrorism we see, yeah.
Right. And so the Saudi royal family and the Saudi regime, when the Saudi country was first formed, it was, the House of Saud, and you had they had to get the blessing, basically, of the Wahhabs, of the religious leaders in that area. So their power always kind of depends on the blessing and the legitimacy for that. And the Saudi government and the king in Saudi Arabia, the king, when you see his title, a lot of times it says, you know, his majesty, and it says something to the effect of the custodian of Mecca and Medina. You have these two shrines. So having custody of these holy sites goes to a lot of the prestige. You can imagine the enormous shock to the family to have an embarrassment and humiliation to have gunfire, you know, violence and a takeover of this holy facility in the country, you know, here where they say, well, we're the custodian of this. Not to mention 1979, what also happened in 1979 in that region? You had the overthrow of the Shah of Iran. So you can imagine the shockwave that goes through the Saudi royal family when you see a Islamic revolution of the Shiite variety happening up in nearby Iran. And now on your own soil, you've got this jarring attack by extremists in your own country. What that led to was a fervent desire by the Saudi royal family to placate these most impassioned adherents of Wahhabism, to demonstrate to these people that, no, we are really true Wahhabists with you. And they immediately then, 79 is such a fascinating year. What else happened in 1979? The Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And this was kind of a perfect confluence, because immediately you had the Saudi family wanting to demonstrate its legitimacy. You had the U.S. government wanting to give the Soviet Union a hard time. And so the two governments, the U.S. and Saudi, collaborated in funneling extremists from Saudi Arabia and really all over the world to Afghanistan to engage in jihad, a holy war against the Soviet Union. And so that was, the timing of these things happening together. So really you've got the Saudi royal family demonstrating its legitimacy by funding jihadis and jihadism and extremism elsewhere. And it is sort of a devil's bargain in that, yes, we are funding the very people who would otherwise want to overthrow us, but we're funding them so they won't. You're making a deal with them. And there's some reporting that these deals were explicit in a meeting in France and so forth, between Saudi royals and leaders of Al-Qaeda, but to make a deal that says, look, we'll give you money and support you as you engage in jihad and cause trouble abroad, just don't cause it at home. So that's kind of what we're seeing here. And when people say, why would Saudi Arabia fund this? Because their principal goal is to retain power. And so they are willing to, the Saudi royals, to fund extremism, even if it may, blow up in their quote unquote allies' faces, if that means they get to keep stay in power, keep that lifestyle going. And you can imagine, Wahhabism, if you study bin Laden and understand what his lifestyle was about after he adopted the worldview he did, the Wahhabism preaches that you're very, you live very parsimoniously, that you don't indulge in luxury and all this type of thing. I mean, what a contrast. We the images of the Saudi royal family, gold-plated 747 bathrooms and,
It's the House of Saud. Yeah.
Yeah. We're talking estates and prostitution and buying giant yachts. It's the absolute opposite of that. So to demonstrate, we do all that, but look what else we do. We're funding jihad around the world. So leave us at home. Leave us alone at home. That kind of sums up why Saudi Arabia did this. It's not so much that it was a Saudi government objective to attack the World Trade Center. It was more like it's a Saudi government objective to placate extremists so they won't attack them at home. So we'll give them money and some other things to do things abroad, and we'll continue to hold power at home. And maybe, and so it's not clear to what extent who knew what, whether – who knew that the nature of 9/11 was going to happen, or was it just we know they're up to something, but we don't ask too many questions about it.
It's like looking the other way. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah.
I really want to get into your interview with, Kenneth Williams, but I think as a little bit of background to that, I want you to talk a little bit about the lawsuits going on now and this thing, JASTA or JASTA.
Yeah.
What is that, and how does it tie into all of this?
Yeah, the 9/11 family members, 9/11 survivors, and insurance companies have been pursuing a civil liability suit against 9/11 to hold them liable, the government of Saudi Arabia, for its alleged support of the 9/11 attacks through the type of things we're talking about, the San Diego cell and other type of things like that. So they've been pursuing this suit. Suing a foreign country is an extraordinarily complicated area of law. There's something called the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that kind of dictates when. The general assumption is you can't sue a foreign government, and so the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act spells out, okay, here are the exceptions where you can do that. And they've been pursuing this case for a while and running into interpretations of this complex law that says, well, you don't qualify because of this and that. To overcome those objections, they were able to get some members of Congress to draft something called the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA. And JASTA, what it did is modified the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act in a way that kind of cleared those last hurdles that, you know, judges were interpreting things in a certain way, and it's kind of making explicit now that that you can sue foreign governments in these circumstances when terrorism is related. The word Saudi Arabia does not appear anywhere in JASTA. It's just saying that under this, given certain circumstances, you know, you can proceed with a civil case against a foreign government. So JASTA was passed in 2016, a few months after the 28 pages came out, and President Obama vetoed it. And then it was the only override of his entire term in office was Congress overrode that, and JASTA was enacted into law. So now that let this case proceed onward. And now we are in the discovery phase of that trial. And first it was a limiting of the scope of it. You know, there are arguments about, you know, what grounds could be sued upon. And so now pretty much that case is hinging, as of now, on the San Diego scenario that I described earlier with these two future hijackers and the involvement of this Omar Bayoumi and Thumairy from the Saudi consulate, and these people trying to link those connections together.
And there's lobbyists for Saudi Arabia that have been hired to try to weaken this Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act too.
Yes, before JASTA was passed, when it was in the works, which, you know, was over a couple of years, I guess, you had the Saudi lobby, which is enormous, hugely funded, multiple firms. I mean, really breathtaking in the scope of this. You had them fighting to prevent it from being passed. Okay, then once it was passed, they went into overdrive, launching a counterattack, engaged even more lobbyists to weaken it, you know, to change the provisions of it. And there are two champions of their cause, the Saudi cause in Congress, were Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham, were the kind of carrying the Saudi water for them on that, on trying to weaken it. They engaged in some very scandalous tactics, which listeners, if they go to 28pages.org, you'll see one of the top navigation links says Saudi lobbying scandal. I reported on this extensively. Just to give a brief summary, one of the things these Saudi firms did, the worst example of this misconduct, was they told U.S. military service members that JASTA put them at risk, that they could be sued in other countries. It's absolutely false. It's not. There's nothing to it. And so first they told them that. Then they invited them, hey, a bunch of your fellow service members are going to Washington, D.C. to fight this law that could put U.S. service members in harm's way. Would you like to go help support it? We'll pay all your expenses. So these veterans, they were specifically focusing on combat veterans. I mean, they've been through hell. A lot of them, you know, when they get a call to action like this to do something good for their fellow veterans, you know, they're all in. So a lot of these people participated. Nobody ever told them that this was, I've got many interviews at the website with veterans who said they didn't tell me this was for Saudi Arabia. And a couple, one of the Marines I interviewed, he made the point that he had enlisted because of 9/11, and then to find out that he had been tricked into lobbying on behalf of the government that was trying to avoid accountability, you know, for its alleged links to the attacks. You can imagine how that went over with him. So that was kind of the worst of it. Well, this campaign went on and was ultimately not successful. That's not to say it's over. They could still be, even as we speak, you know, pulling other strings and trying to weaken it as well. So they tried to weaken it right after it came out. But it's now, you know, the case is proceeding, and now we're in the discovery phase where, you know, the sides of the suits have to, you know, produce documents and evidence and so forth.
And I think that can tie into your latest story on 28 pages about a former FBI agent who was told not to help these 9/11 victims build a case against Saudi Arabia. Kenneth Williams and the Phoenix memo. Could you tell us about that?
You bet. Kenneth Williams, a retired FBI agent, and he has a very prominent role and the interesting role in the whole story of 9/11. Listeners may be familiar, remember something called the Phoenix memo, or maybe they don't remember by that term, but what it was a warning by an FBI agent sent to headquarters saying that he suspected, and this is sent in July of 2001.
So, July 10th, 2001, FBI headquarters.
Right, so weeks before the attack, sends it to headquarters. He was stationed in Arizona, and he had been investigating extremists in Arizona. There's Embry-Riddle University, Aeronautical University there, and he had noticed in his report, a multi-page report, says that we've got a lot of extremists who are enrolled in aeronautical and flight training, and he recommended that the FBI basically create a whole list of aeronautical institutions across America and establish contacts with them to see if they'd been observing suspicious behavior by anyone. Of course, we all know now that there was a lot of suspicious behavior. Pilots who weren't terribly interested in learning how to take off or land, that type of thing. So, if you think about it, you think they probably had a good chance of possibly foiling the attack. That memo was written by Kenneth Williams. Kenneth Williams is the one we're talking about. He's retired now. And last year, attorneys representing the 9/11 plaintiffs, the family members, survivors, insurance companies, contacted him to ask if they could talk to him and to ask some questions and get his help. They didn't want him to disclose any classified information. They just want to speak to him as an expert, on whatever he could share that he had learned that is not classified. He notified FBI just kind of as a courtesy or heads up. After 27 or 30 years career, he's kind of used to letting headquarters know what he's up to. And several days later, he gets a call from the Office of the General Counsel at FBI headquarters. And they tell him, we don't want you helping these 9/11 family members, because they gave two reasons. They said because of ongoing litigation involving the U.S. government, they could be harmed. And they didn't specify what that was. And the worst answer, because the Trump administration is trying to have a good relationship with Saudi Arabia. You'd think you could at least make up a better, I guess we can credit them for being honest with the horrible truth of what their motive was there. But so Kenneth Williams then, he initially complied with their directive. He didn't like it. He felt immediately racked with guilt. He feels like the FBI and the intelligence community let down 9/11 families once, and now here we are telling them that we can't help you try to find out more facts about the possibility of Saudi links to the deaths of your loved ones. So he ends up changing his mind, and earlier this year deciding that, whatever I can tell these 9/11 plaintiffs' attorneys without disclosing classified information, I'm going to do.
Wow. And I suggest readers check that story out. And since you mentioned the Trump thing, one of Trump's platforms was, supporting release of those 28 pages. And you have an article about that where, you get into details of a leaked email suggesting that the campaign killed that, platform plank.
Yeah, there was it wasn't so much Trump's platform as the broader GOP platform for 2016. This was before the 28 pages came out, and the
Trump did publicly support the release of those 28 pages, though, I believe.
He did. Yeah, and during the campaign, he the 20 pages were in the media and in discussion. And he had a couple of stops during this campaign. He had said he was criticizing the invasion of Iraq, and he said, you know, it wasn't the Saudis who brought down the World Trade Center. You may find out it was someone else. There's some very secret papers, and you may find out it was Saudi Arabia that did it, but you will find out. So he was kind of supportive of that and explicitly naming Saudi Arabia. Then you had the GOP, somebody who was, you know, taking an interest in this drive to introduce a plank for the Republican 2016 platform, you know, its statement of issues and topics that it wanted to address, and urging the release of the 28 pages. It made it out of the first committee, then it goes to the final vote, and it was shot down in flames. And yeah, some emails recently came out. This conversation between, I want to say, a UAE royal and others, and cronies of the Trump administration. They were talking about, oh, we got this killed out of the Republican platform. It was really fascinating a couple of years later to find out that backstory on this. So yeah, you see here you had Trump saying those pages should come out, but you've got his cronies, apparently,
including Paul Manafort.
Yeah, you've got them kind of celebrating the fact that it was taken out of there. And it's always a question with Trump as to what his beliefs are and to what extent the cronies he's surrounded with him are doing things contrary to that, or whether he has any core convictions at all. I mean, just for a brief example, not to digress too much, but, you know, here Trump was very outspoken, very candid, right in front of a Republican audience in criticizing the invasion of Iraq, calling it a tremendous mistake and so forth. But now you fast forward, and his national security advisor, Bolton, is one of the chief architects and cheerleaders of that invasion. So I mean, he surrounded himself with people who advanced the policies that he criticized. And you've got the contrast of him saying, hey, you may find out it was Saudi Arabia who knocked down the World Trade Center. And fast forward, he's in office, and he departs from the tradition of the first presidential visit to a foreign country being either Mexico or Canada, and bestows that honor upon Saudi Arabia. Your listeners may recall him dancing with swords with the Saudi royal family, and now we've got these enormous weapon deals. You've got the Trump administration all in facilitating the Saudi war in Yemen. So you know, no matter who gets in this office, though, it seems that bending to the will of the Saudi government, you know, it's definitely a bipartisan affair, you know, through all administrations.
And do you would you have time for one more question? Because I sure. think there's one last question I have to ask, because people always bring it up with these ongoing lawsuits. You know, it's sort of a two-pronged question. People say, well, the lawsuits won't go anywhere because national security reasons. And then the other thing is, people will say, well, we have too many economic ties to Saudi Arabia to let these civil lawsuits, and I believe they are civil lawsuits, to go forward.
Yes. Mm-hmm. What was the first half of that question?
The national security aspect.
Oh, yeah. You know, and you know, it's one of the things Kenneth Williams, the FBI agent that I interviewed, he says, look, 17 years is a lifetime in intelligence work. He said there's no reason why any of that stuff should still be classified. And Senator Graham once said that, you know, a lot of times much of what is classified for ostensibly for reasons of national security is really classified to shield certain parties from embarrassment, you know, whether by uncovering, by concealing their misconduct or their negligence or embarrassing the Saudi royal family. So, you know, the national security arguments fall flat, and, you know, people who were 9/11 commissioners too say that there's no reason the vast majority of this stuff can't come out all these many years later. You've got a consistent pattern of concealing Saudi government links to 9/11. I guess we won't get into it here, but listeners, just go to 20pages.org and put Sarasota in the search box, and you'll kind of go down a whole other avenue of a wealthy Saudi family that vacated its residence just days before 9/11 in Sarasota and apparently had links to the 9/11 hijackers, but that was kept under wraps even from Senator Bob Graham. Yeah, it just seems clear from the 28 pages that, you know, they're, you know, they've come out, they've still got some redactions, but you can see there was no national security reason for that, even though that was given the reason given then, and there's certainly no valid national security reason now. This is about shielding this U.S.-Saudi relationship. As for, you know, should we put economic considerations in front of justice for the mass murder of nearly 3,000 people? You know, no. And but that does kind of get back to why this. There's so many parties that have an interest in preserving the status quo between these two governments. Everybody talks about oil, but you know the oil trade. But the other half is the weapons trade. The enormous weapon sales from the United States to Saudi Arabia. And so you've got all these businesses who have a keen interest in not tipping the apple cart over and just let this great ride continue for us. You know, Northrop Grumman and the other major defense contractors. Now they in turn, when you talk about Saudi influence on our decision-making and attitudes in this country, the influence extends, you know, I talked about the lobbying firms that they have. It goes well beyond that. You've got Saudi influence on U.S. think tanks as well. For example, the Center for Strategic and International Studies receives money from Saudi Arabia. And they also receive money from all those defense contractors. And their output for this think tank is just even worse than you'd expect. I mean, they can't even hide it. I mean, a lot of their material looks like it was written by, you know, as a Saudi press release. But these think tanks are the ones that journalists reach out to for comment and perspective. And you've got, that Saudi influence running through that and infecting that as well. And other countries are playing that same game too. It's not just Saudi Arabia. But no, ultimately, you know, the American people deserve to have facts. Not, you know, the 9/11 families do and survivors do. But the American people do too. And we need to just reassess all these relationships. And could there be an economic disruption from a different relationship with Saudi Arabia? Yeah, maybe. They still need to sell their oil. That country is increasingly on financial thin ice. And so they own that. They have that oil, but it's useless to them unless they sell it. So they're still interested in selling it. To the extent they decrease production, we saw recently the big boom in the technology of drilling here in the United States. So to the extent the price goes up, that makes drilling here in the United States even more viable. So we need to pursue justice, let the facts go out, and then let markets work and do what they do in terms of adapting to the repercussions of otherwise. Otherwise, we're really sacrificing morality to this. If we're all going to collectively say, well, to keep gas from going up 50 cents or whatever it might be, or to boost the S&P 500 by virtue of Boeing and Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin and others who are doing business in Saudi Arabia, we're going to give them a pass.
I was going to add too, Canada and Saudi Arabia have pretty robust economic ties, and yet Canada's firing back at Saudi Arabia for things now. So maybe the tides are turning.
Perhaps, yeah. And it's the other thing we have to keep in mind too is that this, we're talking about 9/11, but this is all very current to the notion of holding Saudi Arabia accountable, because by all indications, they've continued to fund extremism around the world, whether it's sending money to Wahhabist and Salafist madrasas in Pakistan and around the world, that where you have imams preaching a very violent and dark version of Islam, to helping support Al-Qaeda affiliates and other extremists in Syria. Now, here Here, it's not just Saudi Arabia that's the bad guy. We've got our own U.S. government falling into that same pattern. Remember, we talked earlier about 1979, right? How the U.S. government working with Saudi Arabia helped whip up extremism, bring it to Afghanistan to combat the Soviet Union. We've never stopped doing this behavior of funding and aiding extremism to pursue some foreign policy goal. And that, you know, is absolutely what happened in Syria with, you know, the latest disastrous regime change. Is you've got U.S. weapons in the hands of Al-Qaeda affiliates. You've got reporting a couple weeks ago that people should look at from the Associated Press in Yemen, where the, you know, Saudi-led coalition in that war, and which includes the United States, were refueling and doing targeting and that type of thing. AP reported that people on the ground said, we know that they let a convoy of Al-Qaeda, you know, move from point A to point B without being harmed. So you've got us in a de facto alliance with Al-Qaeda there. So it kind of gets back to this war on terror, and what does it really mean? And the unfortunate truth is that the U.S. government is really, by its own behavior, has not been dedicated to eradicating terrorism. It's been more dedicated to selectively cultivating it. You know, we'll fund it and promote it in Syria in hopes that it'll help bring down the Assad regime. Not that that Assad regime is any danger whatsoever to U.S. citizens. It might be to whatever other interests the U.S. government has over there, but not American citizens' interests.
Well, it gets into the what the intelligence agencies call blowback.
Exactly. So to the extent that we keep giving Saudi Arabia a pass and keep giving our own government a pass, it does blow back. We're causing enormous suffering in Syria and in Yemen with the, you know, destabilizing countries, and with these drone attacks and with these negligent and inaccurate Saudi bombing attacks that hit wedding parties and school buses and so forth. That creates huge bad will against the United States. And, you know, who suffers? It's, you know, U.S. citizens who are suffered in the terrorist attacks that result. Unfortunately, on this treadmill that is the war of terror, when that blowback happens, the government just uses it as a justification to say, oh, look, see, now we really need to get serious about it. And so they just use it to justify the next round, when really they're creating more terrorists than they're eliminating.
Right. And a way to attack, you know, our civil liberties. But that's another issue.
That's right.
Entirely.
Yeah.
So I know I've kept you a little bit over time here. How can my listeners support the work you are doing with 28pages.org and what the 9/11 families are doing?
Yeah, a couple things. First, I would, in order to stay plugged in on this issue, on these issues and developments, I would encourage them to go to 28pages.org, and there's a subscribe button. It's free. All this does is give you a email alert when new content is published there, and that's only usually a couple times a month, so you're not going to get junk mail or anything at all. But also to follow 28 Pages on Twitter at 28 Pages. There's a Facebook page as well. Unfortunately, and listeners might be aware of this, Facebook has been really suffocating. It's not an efficient way to follow alternative media now, because Facebook, I have nearly 5,000 followers there, and Facebook might show my posted like 400 of them now, because I guess I'm not reliable news. But the New York Times that was key in facilitating the invasion of Iraq on false pretenses, you know, that's to be trusted. But that's another episode too. So you can follow those ways. Now, as far as helping to support, you know, the 28 pages were just the tip of the iceberg. There's probably maybe even a better metaphor is needed than that, because as far as how many more documents, it's breathtaking what is still classified relating to 9/11. For example, there's a memorandum for record based on the interview by the U.S. government of Prince Bandar, asking him about this money flowing to this extremist in San Diego. Completely classified. That's just one example. There's many more like that. And then the more documents that come out, the more the 9/11 families too can possibly develop a more compelling case as they pursue that. And we're all about the facts. You know, we want more facts to come out. A great way to help support that effort would be to contact your senators and your House representative. There are two resolutions right now that are urging the broad declassification of material relating to 9/11. I'm just going to pause here and let your listeners grab a pen. Call this phone number, 202-224-3121. That'll get you to the House of Representatives. And contact your congressperson and ask them to co-sponsor House Resolution 663. This phone call could literally last just a minute. All you're doing is saying, please have the congressperson co-sponsor House Resolution 663 to urge the release of 9/11 documents. And you can, you've checked your box. And then you can call your senators at 202-225-3121. And there you're asking for, co-sponsoring Senate Resolution 597. So it's Senate Resolution 597 and House Resolution 663. And, you know, that's how we got the 28 pages out, was building this momentum on Capitol Hill. And your listeners can help us do the same thing with many more of these documents now.
And I think the work you've been doing, I think, you know, the fact that we got the 28 pages, it's a reason to be hopeful.
Absolutely, it does give reason for hope. And all these many years later, these facts need to come out so that there's kind of two big overarching avenues of this, so that 9/11 families and survivors can pursue justice, but also so that the American people can make informed judgments about our foreign policy and our relationships with various governments. It's vital to our system of government that we have this transparency. We're a government of and for the people, and those documents are our documents, and they need to be in our hands and in our full view so we can render the right judgments about the direction of U.S. foreign policy and the war on terror.
Well, Brian, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views. I urge all my listeners to support your work and the work of September 11th advocates.
Thank you. And you know that support only comes to me in the form of your eyeballs. Yeah, when you go to 20page.org, when I said subscribe, there's no charge, there's no advertising on the site. It's pretty much a pro bono thing. There is an opportunity if people want to chip in money, but I don't care if you do that ultimately. It's really about this is pro bono journalism for the most part. And just getting more facts in front of more people.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Brian McGlinchey and will consider supporting his work at 28pages.org. Brian wanted me to give a quick update in regards to the Senate and House resolutions, and how you can contact your senators and representatives to co-sponsor these resolutions. The resolution numbers have changed. They are, for your senators, Senate Resolution 610. You can reach your senators to co-sponsor Senate Resolution 610 at 202-224-3121. And if you're looking to contact your representatives, you want to ask them to co-sponsor House Resolution 663. That's House Resolution 663. And you can contact your representatives at 202-225-3121. That's 202-225-3121. Until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem.
But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.